Welcome to another episode of Fukin Conversation. I'm so excited today. I have William F. Pinar here on the podcast today, and he's a professor at the University of British Columbia. He held a Canada Research Chair there for 14 years and is now the professor of the Ted Aoki Curriculum Studies. You can correct me if I'm wrong on that, Bill. I don't know if we call it the chair or it's just like that, professor of the Ted Aoki Curriculum Studies. Well, I'm so excited to have you on the show, and I have so many questions for you. And how are you doing?
Oh, I'm excited to be speaking with you, Nicholas. It's we've had a long conversation, two decades, and I look forward to this one.
All right, Bill. As I mentioned, I was reminded in relation to what my students have expressed in terms of what has been distressing for them this week, especially students who self-identify as being racialized as Black, in terms of what they've been witnessing and trying to deal with that, and their academic study in relation to their own lived experience has been really difficult for them this week. And also the sense of how do we respond, as whether you self-identify as being a racialized white teacher or teacher educator, or even just a citizen. And I was reminded of your book that we took up actually after 9/11, when I was down at LSU, The Gender of Racial Politics and Violence in America, Lynching, Prison Rape, and the Crisis of Masculinity. And I just wanted to read a passage out of it. You say, what is melancholic for me, or should I say what leaves me in mourning, is to live among and teach white people who remember nothing, perceive racism as merely attitudinal, as common among Black folks as among white, and most surprisingly, having nothing to do with them. In such a setting, to remember lynching and the struggle against it is perhaps what Eppert terms a revisionary task, for it involves, as Eppert suggests, an order of bearing witness that requires not merely the evidentiary recounting of historical events, but a more active accounting of and for them. And I know in your work and the works that you sent to me that you're calling us to attune ourselves to the past in relation to the present. So I was wondering how you've been thinking about the protests and the outrage and the riots for the public murder of Black men, women, and children that people bared witness to on, you know, different social media platforms. How you've been thinking about that in relation to your work as a curriculum theorist and an American citizen?
I'm horrified by the murder of Mr. Floyd, heartened by protests, although chagrined that some of them have been usurped by criminals, horrified at Trump's outrageous response to them. All of it drives home again, yet again, the persistence of the past, not only the ongoing legacies of racism, and colonialism, and imperialism in our political, social, and economic lives, the privileges that accrue unequally from those, but also how deeply embedded these phenomena are psychologically, how they contaminate our daily lives in ways subtle and not so subtle, and which complicates the challenge that teachers face, anti-racist educators face, that all of us face, especially those of us who are descended from European peoples, from people who identify as quote white. Yet again, another somewhat series of events that remind me that the past persists, in fact, that the future is not in front of us, but in back, that we can never aspire to make racial progress without a reactivation, a re-experiencing of the past in us so that we can challenge it directly. The culture of denial seems so profound and omnipresent.
And you made reference to Donald Trump. And I know in your most recent edition of What is Curriculum Theory, you stress the importance of, if not journalists, teachers are those who we seek to at least share some sort of relevancy of a sort of truth through the curriculum in terms of what our children might experience at schools. And the ways in which your critique of this kind of desubjectification, if you will, through social media and what's believable or what's not believable in the current present moment in terms of what we're witnessing through social media. And in much of your recent work, well, to me, you even took this up in the first edition of What is Curriculum Theory, about this constant push for data and technology. And I'm just wondering how you're thinking about, as we have like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram at our fingertips and engaging what's going on, say, for example, myself here being in Canada and looking at what's going on in the US, how you've been thinking about that as well, of how the social media and technology in relation to our own subject formation to this current moment in time, and now people, and despite the health risks of going out for in relation to 2020 pandemic, are willing to put their lives on the line because of those risks are amplified. And as we see in the data, marginalized communities, whether you're Black, Hispanic, Indigenous, here in Canada or the US, are being affected so much more than people like myself, who's able to live in the safety of my home. So yeah, I was just wondering your thoughts on your work in relation to your critique of technology and what's taking place right now.
Well, before I respond directly to that question, let me return to your earlier statement about my connection of abstractions with events through endnoting, especially news reports. The precarious status of the fact has a long history, of course, but within recent decades and within curriculum studies itself, there have been invocations of post-structuralist critiques of politics of discourse, how language not only shapes reality, but how itself is predicated on negations and denials, and especially of its own constructiveness. Even the idea that history itself is fictional, initially a nod to the historiographic craft, the sense in which the historian, him or herself, is involved in the narration of past events, but became generalized to apply to question really all factual claims as in some way only interpretive or in some way necessarily fictional. That coupled with the omnipresence of social media, which seems to have had a number of effects, which are also chronicled in many places, scholarly studies as well as the newspapers, but an increase in plagiarism, apparent disinclination to accept that ideas belong to people that have some kind of authentic relation to the originators, which seems to undermine not only the status of the fact, but any sense of any ethical obligation to facts, rendering everything just an interpretation. So even climate change, for example, which is indisputable, gets denied, and in classrooms, apparently. I don't know, in Canada, I've read the reports in the United States where students are encouraged by their parents and others to challenge their teachers in science class, insisting that the data is mixed and that it's simply an interpretation. Technology's obviously had many benefits. It's indispensable, omnipresent. It's not going anywhere. At the same time, though, it's had many distressing effects. intensification of bullying and hazing and identity theft. And a certain, what I would think of as a disillusion. I understand subjectivity as the empty space between self and the world. And so that you, it's what enables you to talk about myself, that you have a self, or that you have a body, or that you're in the world. It's that that empty space that enables self-reflection and self-reflexivity and agency. It dissolves. And this has the effect, too, of questioning the stability. And I thought that might be you, Nicholas.
Yeah, I'm still here. It wasn't me.
So at any rate, one effect of social media seems to me to be to undermine any solid sense of the self, partly due to the fusion with the screen. The screen is so captivating, we seem to disappear into it. Of course, that kind of absorption in the past has always been celebrated as a kind of welcome feature of aesthetic experience. But there's something, I think, more mischievous involved with the computer screen, especially as we accommodate ourselves to the software design that makes it function and requires us to comply with its instructions. So the effect is a kind of subjugation to the screen, a fusion which contracts this empty space of subjectivity, and with it, in a sense of critical reflection, self-reflexivity, and agency. That's a bundle of ideas all tracked together. Maybe you want to focus on one or move on, whatever suits you.
I do see, you know, in terms of my own use of social media, it's certainly crafted in the kind of subjectivity that you would like to put out there. And then also just getting caught up in distractions. And as you say, like the navigation or negotiation of the different images or even news feeds that are being presented to individuals, and how does one critically engage that? And I have yet to see my sons take that up in the school curriculum in relation to, you know, how do we construct our own subjectivity in relation to social media, or even understanding the implications of one's relationality to it and others through it, in a kind of critical stance to how we're using it per se. So I can.
That's deeply disappointing that technology is uncritically embraced by educators as only an ends to a means to presumably facilitate learning, to provoke interest and so on. Never the subject of their own critical inquiry, and exactly as you phrased it, an ongoing opportunity to study what's happening to them, especially to so-called digital natives, as mm-hmm. they are immersed in the technological sensorium.
Yeah, and it might be, I mean, you know, my eldest is in grade 9 now, and maybe hopefully they take this conversation up later as part of the school curriculum, but certainly we have that conversation in our household. And Lorianne, unlike me, is probably a lot more aligned as you in terms of not engaging social media at all, nor does she encourage it amongst the three boys as part of her household curriculum and what we do at home. Because I know this, I know students, and I know others familiar with your work are interested in the thinking that went into the three different editions of what is curriculum theory. And I certainly can see, I don't know if I'd call it necessarily an evolution in your thinking, but can see the different concepts that you have extended throughout the different editions. So, for example, whether that's thinking about Carrere, and then in relation to regression in the American South and place, or in the second edition, thinking about the concept of allegory, in relation to Carrere in the Weimar period in Germany, in terms of what we might learn from that in relation to the present and how we might reimagine the future. And then in this latest edition, Harlem Renaissance, and really kind of focusing on allegory, but two concepts that I see coming back to in whether that's in your other recent book, Moving Images of Eternity, George Grant's critique of time, teaching, and technology, are these concepts of reactivation and reconstruction. And I know that you've dealt with these two concepts in different works over, you know, the course of the last 30, 40 years. So I'm just wondering if I'm interested in knowing how are you thinking through the different ways in which you approach the three editions of what is curriculum theory?
It's an interplay between the past and the present that's at work. That's made part of the method of Curry. But it's evident, for example, in the first edition, the 2004, which is very much animated by my outrage over No Child Left Behind and the scapegoating of teachers in the United States. And so I employed the reminded readers of the tradition of autobiography among African Americans, including the slave narratives, as well the research on African American enslaved women who talked back to their owners and to plantation managers. I was so heartened and inspired to read about these instances where women risked their lives to protect their children from being sold or beaten or murdered, and who did so simply by getting in the face of the plantation owner or the plantation manager and screaming at him, sometimes physically responding by striking him. And while I wasn't suggesting that that teachers employ these methods, I was pointing out that some form of intransigence might be ethically obligatory in a period in which children were being abused by these so-called reforms. So I wanted to illustrate how the curriculum is both evidentiary in the upper quotation that you read earlier. It's about the facts of the past, but it's also about associating them with the present. In the second edition, I was horrified by the movement to the right and the Republican Party specifically, and what it seemed to me to foreshadow, which as it turns out was the election of Donald Trump. And so I shifted my attention from enslaved women to a study of the Weimar Republic. Fascinating in itself for many reasons, intrinsically important, but also highly suggestive for the present moment in the United States of how democracy could be hijacked by propaganda, by violence, by right-wing manipulations of democratic structures. And so I focused on this idea of allegory, a literary concept, but to remind readers and teachers and students that facts are facts in themselves, but they also have significance beyond them, which seems to me the essence of educational experience. We study facts because they're important, but we study them also because they speak to us in some way, that they speak to the present moment and where wherein we live. And I wanted to illustrate that with Weimar. And then the third edition you mentioned, the Harlem Renaissance, I was drawn to that for two reasons. The major reason was that in this horrible situation of Trump in the United States and Erdogan in Turkey and what's happening in China and Hungary and Poland and now Brazil, this rise of right-wing populism and racial and political polarization, here was an example of artists who, in arguably much worse circumstances, somehow managed to find inner strength and the release of their own creativity, their own social solidarity, adding also their own sexual experimentation as part of this remarkable mix of that's been characterized as a renaissance of African-American culture in the United States. And I was particularly interested in Alain Locke, the central figure and the architect of the Renaissance, whose collection, The New Negro, introduced it to the broader black and white publics, because he stressed intercultural relations. And that was the second reason I chose the Harlem Renaissance, was that the racial polarization within curriculum studies itself, the retreat, the amplification of identity and its weaponizing to divide scholars who have a common cause. And I wanted to express, to remind contemporary black colleagues in the United States that there was a time when public intellectuals, African-American public intellectuals, embraced and were willing to negotiate intercultural solidarity, interracial solidarity. And so I very much hope that that 100-year-old idea might be reactivated. There's much of the past, of course, that we hope we never revisit, even though it does seem to be revisiting us. But there's much in the past that can be retrieved and brought into our lives today that could be very helpful as an antidote to the conformism and the subjection that we suffer today, but also as provocations to create what's novel and contemporaneous and appropriate to the moment that's unfolding. And so what has always concerned me has been this kind of domination of consumer culture, this in academe, and this conversion of academicians into entrepreneurs, creating new conceptual products which they attempt to sell and enhance their own capacity for monetizing their careers. In so doing, of course, we abandon entirely the secularization of our sacred calling to be truth seekers and truth tellers. And these ancient, and now we dismiss as cliched, truths I wanted to remind students of, as truth-telling and truth-seeking is obviously central to the curriculum.
What I've always appreciated about your work is the ways in which you set up the backdrop for what's taking place in relation to the very concept of curriculum, whether that is in relation to the curriculum as planned, implemented, or lived, to take up Teddy Oakey's work. And so in much of your work, whether that's the Weimar era or Reconstruction in the South, you've looked at several of the different presidencies and federal policies and the implications that those have had for curriculum across the United States. Unlike Canada, the U.S., since the late 1950s, 60s, has the federal government has had much of a larger hand in directing what teachers should teach through the funding or threat of defunding certain programs if states don't follow along. In Canada, as you know, it's provincial, and one of the first things that Doug Ford did when his PC government got into place was to stop all of the equity initiatives that had been put in place with the prior Liberal government. And so I've really appreciated how in your work, for example, tracing the launch of Sputnik in 1957 through the Kennedy administration and this push for a certain form of gendered curriculum and a football team ethos in which you take up to Nixon, to Reagan, Bush Sr., Clinton, Bush Jr., even Obama and Trump. So it seems to me in your work and the ways in which you revisit it, I don't know if there was anyone prior, but at least in terms of who you've reviewed as, in relation to the backdrop, the political, the larger national backdrop to the context of how curriculum is being taken up in the U.S., that it hasn't been favorable in terms of thinking about teachers, and you refer to this as their gracious submission or delivering other people's mail. And I'm wondering, in this last edition that you nod a little bit to Trump, and I understand that perhaps it's too close at hand, but I'm wondering how you're thinking about that shift in terms of what you've looked at from 1957 until now, What have been those key moments or and remaining concerns for you as a curriculum scholar and curriculum theorist in relation to the very concept of how curriculum is being taken up in the United States, or even as you cross the border to here in Canada?
It's at a quite a level of abstraction, I suppose, but if there's a common theme, it's the instrumentalization of the curriculum. In the Kennedy administration in the 1960s in the U.S., it was seen as a way to get America moving again, that the United States was disadvantaged vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, given the launching of Sputnik. In the 1980s, it was a fear of Japan, and economic crisis, an idea, political idea, that was dated really through all of the talk about 2000 and the new millennium. And the common core idea seems to me to be a bit of an Obama-like compromise between earlier Republican assertions of standards and academic quality, but also a nod to a kind of updated utilitarianism, still a version of instrumentality. What you get in with Betsy DeVos, of course, and Trump, is the complete corruption of public education. Her latest move, as you may know, has been to take the billions of the dollars that Congress passed to address the COVID emergency, dollars that were addressed to poor, mostly urban school districts in the U.S., to help feed children for many of whom their only meals were available at school. It was also efforts to provide, you know, computers and other devices that enabled them to participate in remote learning. It was money that was specifically addressed to these poor districts, and DeVos has directed that half of it be given to private Christian schools and wealthy schools. So regardless of the economic situation of the students or the schools, in fact, many of the schools to which she's trying to send the money are quite wealthy. So there's this complete corruption. But the through line is the instrumentalization of the curriculum, rather than it being intrinsically important of its own as a kind of truth-seeking and truth-telling, this interplay between the past and the present.
It's almost akin, because I know you make reference to there's policies in place. And again, I mean, here in Ontario, prior to the 2020 pandemic, the biggest concern for high school teachers was this call to increase class size, their workload. I returned to grad school in the late 1990s because of Bill 160. And there again was a call to increase our workload and our relationship to the school curriculum in many ways in terms of what we were teaching was changing back then. And also, they've since backed down. I mean, I think it's a moot point in terms of what we're experiencing now, but this call for high school students to do, at first it was a minimum of 4 courses online. Now it's 2. And as you know, all students are online at the moment. And so there's this fear, and legitimately so, that online learning will become the new norm for students in the fall, and that if teachers are unwilling, high school teachers, to do this, that the politicians will seek private companies to provide the necessary online learning for kids like my son to be able to do his work. I mean, when we talk about instrumentalization of online learning and a teacher-proof curriculum that you're speaking to, it definitely resonates here in Ontario.
I'm sorry to hear that. It's an economic agenda that favors privatization. They would very much like private companies to take over the delivery of instruction as it's framed. Even just as horrifying as that prospect, the apparent partnership between Pearson and IBM to create devices that can be placed under children's skin that will provide real-time data about their emotional and cognitive states as they attempt to learn whatever they're told they must learn. There's this overall tendency toward a kind of Orwellian brave new world in which computerization, technologization, and the pharmaceutical industry, the surveillance industry team up. Children will learn or else. The question of what they should learn, of course, not raised. That's another issue, if I can bring it up briefly, that seems to me the pandemic underlines, and that is how overdue any curriculum reorganization is, and not only in secondary schools, but in elementary schools as well. This kind of the entrenched school subjects, mirroring more or less the academic disciplines at the university, I think needs to be seriously challenged. At the secondary level, I advocate a series of what could be short courses, 6 weeks long, that would be left to local jurisdictions to decide, but focused on the emergencies of the moment. They would, of course, be informed by the school subjects and the academic disciplines, but they would be focused on what's happening now. For example, in your earlier lamentation about the absence of any critical examination of technology in your son's schools. So certainly social media would be a topic now, the pandemic itself, obviously an occasion to teach biology and a number, and poverty, the unequal distribution of suffering associated with the pandemic to economically disadvantaged groups and minority groups. And so you see, my point is then this effort to make sure students learn is yoked to the economy and not to the human development of children, and that by reorganizing the curriculum around topics that students themselves may in fact request would give us something of a chance, at least, to show that academic knowledge can help students not just get good jobs, but also to help understand what's happening to them and what's happening in the world.
The organizational structure, as you point out, of the curriculum based on the academic subjects at the, you know, trying to mirror what's being expected at the university. And even the university, I know recently, the conversations in terms of the administrators at university and program directors are being forced to rethink the ways in which they offer university programming, even the curriculum. And they talk about programs at the university level, but not per se the sense of curriculum as planned, implemented, or lived, and are actually thinking that. And I'm always caught with this tension of there's this opportunity to be innovative, and they're creating courses in relation to the pandemic and how students can come to the university and leverage the resources there to make sense of their lived experiences in relation to their academic studies and the pandemic, for example. But also on the flip side is it used as a marketing tool for universities to kind of compete over attracting students to their institution as a way of doing business as usual under the guise of addressing the anxieties of students that are occurring during this pandemic. So that I know that's been a tension for me in trying to think through that. And then and as you said, really thinking about how outdated the structure and organization of the curriculum in high schools, as one example, still dating back to 20th turn of the century industrialized model of piecemeal with the bell signaling your lunch break at 10 and when you can take lunch and your afternoon break in the afternoon and when you can go home after a 6 to 8 hour workday.
Right. Well, I appreciate your point about the commercialization of universities. Certainly that affects our lives, faculty and students. I'll be curious, and no doubt you will be too, what happens in the fall. I know that UBC depends very much on non-Canadian students, and it'll be interesting to see what happens financially if they don't come this year due to the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just coming back, a free associative idea of when you were talking about how the links between technology, progress, a shift to the right and the commodification of education. The whole, if you referred to it in your earlier works as this concept of teacher-proof curriculum, I'm thinking about at its worst, if we're thinking about where technology is heading in terms of the auto industry, and we're thinking about the Ford plant in relation to schools preparing people for this factory model of education. Well, now we're talking about AI and driverless cars. So, I mean, the rationale, if we can have a driverless car, can we have, you know, a teacherless classroom? So I see those potential parallels in the kind of narratives that are being put forth in the media about technology and education. I didn't know if you're seeing any driverless cars around where you're at.
No, yeah. Driverless cars yet. But I think your insight is important. I think that to the extent that remote learning, as it were, or online curriculum becomes the quote new normal, it's fashioning students to work remotely. As you know, Facebook now has decided that half of its employees, at least, need never return to the office. And there are these speculations in the post-COVID era, there will be many facets of professional life, office life, that'll be relocated to the home. And so having students stay at home and stare at the screen and do what they're told is very much a continuation of this idea of the curriculum as an assembly line back in the Ford automobile production era, moving to the corporate era when they're trained to be friendly and tolerant and always work together and go with the flow of conversation, a kind of compulsory collaboration, to now this kind of atomized isolation in which it's only you and the screen and what you're directed to do.
You know, students and others who listen to the podcast would be really appreciative in knowing, I know you've written about it in different places, but the fruition of Carrere and how you came to that in collaboration with Madeleine Gramet and also other scholars that have been able to work with you since then. And it's always, you know, when I'm asked students that very first question the first week, like, how can we rethink the isness of curriculum and hold off, and how might we take up Carrere as a way in which we might think about the curriculum as planned, implemented, and lived? So I know students would appreciate maybe if you could, we call it a reactivation in relation to asking you to think back about Carrere and the work that you when it started and how your relationship has been with it over time.
Well, my first articulation of it was in a paper I presented at the 1975 meeting of the American Educational Research Association. That paper is online, I understand, typewritten with not all the corrections. I came to it, that would have been spring 75. So I must have come to it the year before, sometime in 74. I was living in Rochester. I remember I was living at 22 Brighton Street with a number of other people. But how I came to it, I'm not clear. I was very much taken up in the years preceding with existentialism, especially Sartre, and especially his novels, the early Sartre, not the late Marxist Sartre. And then especially Virginia Woolf, whom I'd been introduced to in graduate school. I did 2/3 of my coursework as a graduate student outside the College of Education, a third of it in the English department. And so there's where I was introduced to Woolf, and I was especially taken not only with the beauty and power of her fiction, but its methodological potential, if you would, for us students of education to study our lived experience of what we are undergoing with the curriculum, with the other students, with teachers. And so all of that was in the mix. And I wanted it in distinct phases because it seemed to me even then that the effect of technologization was a kind of an expanded now, not the kind of enlightened now that Buddhism seeks, but a kind of immersion in a temporally empty now. And that, coupled with these narratives of progress and improvement, made the past simply a kind of inconvenient reminder of something best discarded. And I had studied enough Jung and Freud by then to know that the past was a powerful determinant of the present. And so that idea of the regressive as a separate phase came from that sense of that it really was worthwhile to recover one's past, not remember it from the present point of view, but to attempt to return to it, as psychoanalysis asks us to do, to focus on the sensory elements and on the specificities of the experience that took place long ago. But Sartre also, his dispute with Freud was that our fantasies of the future were at least as determinative of the present as the past. And so I included that second stage as the progressive, that is the fantasy, what fantasies of the future are driving us, however reflected those fantasies may be by the past. And then the third, of course, the reasoned interpretation, a kind of an attunement to what's been unearthed, and then pulling yourself back together, sort of the moment in which you begin teaching or you begin interacting with others in the synthesis. Initially it was critiqued as by the neo-Marxist as expression of bourgeois self-enclosure. And so I was turned my attention to the political determinants of selfhood and the way that politics, race, and economics become embedded in psychically. That was a welcome complication of the initial formulation of it. In the What is Curriculum Theory text, which you've mentioned, I wanted to show that that it's not necessarily explicitly autobiographical, that the teacher should necessarily refer to incidents in her own life, but that you can express your life history indirectly, in fact, through the curriculum. When you were recounting my lifelong preoccupation with the curriculum reform in the United States, that certainly was an autobiographically animated interest. That's been my life that we're talking about here, a life that's been very much caught up in all that's happened in the United States, but especially by school reform. Finally, let me just say that that it's more heartening than I can say that others have taken it up and put it to different uses, and some have even criticized my earlier formulations of it. And I think you must know this this journal, the Curriculum Exchange, the Curreri Exchange, which is housed at Miami University of Ohio. And one of the co-directors is your former colleague there at LSU, Denise Taliaferro Bazile. It's been somewhat surprising, It wasn't exactly when I first taught it, and Madeline took it up and gave it a theoretical sophistication that I hadn't yet, and that's evident in the 1976 Tour de Port curriculum. When we first published it didn't exactly... didn't exactly meet a standing ovation. And so it's been both surprising and pleasing for us to see that over the decades that others have found it of interest and use.
Thanks for sharing that, Bill. I know it's interesting because I have students, that are working through Curreri, and I always frame it. We're going to experiment this semester, and we're going to engage in life writing research, and we're going to take up the concept of Curreri. And for each of you, you'll have to figure out how you're comfortable with it and what you're willing to share or make the connections. And I have students this week, some of them saying that they thought to write one's autobiography in relation to one's intellectual study would be easy. You just tell the story, but they're finding they're realizing and going through the process how difficult it is, especially for some of the students. Describing a regressive snapshot, that's one thing. Trying to imagine a different kind of future, that's another. Analyzing it in relation to the concepts, theoretical concepts we're taking up in different people's work, that I can try to work my way through. But the hardest part is the synthetical, is reemerging in the present to try to bring everything back together. And students are struggling and saying, like, I can't make those connections yet. And I stress to them sometimes that, you know, it's taken me a year, maybe even 3 years of thinking through some of these ideas as a curriculum theorist to try to make those connections. It's not something necessarily that can happen over 12 weeks with a certain amount of time spent in a course. And this is just an introduction to how we might do such work.
Well, let me say that I never intended synthesis to be a kind of everlasting or definitive integration of the facts and elements that you had uncovered in the previous phases. It's provisional and situation bound. Even though you intellectually don't have an integrated or coherent sense of your intellectual and life history, you nonetheless pull it together when you start talking in front of a class. And so it becomes embodied in a way that it may not be conceptually developed. And so it's a provisional moment, simply acknowledging that you might even witness to the ways in which you remain disintegrated, or that the elements remain fragmented, or in which you are yourself an unfinished project. So it's not necessarily a one-time only or a definitive, exhaustive study of yourself. You know, Madeline used it in her teacher education courses in a very economical way. She asked her students to recount three teachers who had been important to them, and she left that word importantness ambiguous. So some would remember students teachers that they had loathed. Others remembered teachers that were inspiring. Others remembered ones who had been sort of ordinary and maybe even mundane. And in the analytic, Madeline wanted them to think about how they had influenced them, including how they had influenced their fantasies of the teachers that they themselves would become. These were often prospective teachers, but even for practicing teachers, the teachers that they in fact had become, but may still wish to be. So at any rate, it's possible to, you know, to abbreviate the thing into something much more manageable, if you wish.
But I think that's an important part, and I would not, the struggle to bring things together or the analysis, I would try to stress it's not easy. It's difficult work to take on this kind of work with them. You know, I also, you said like much of your work has been autobiographical in terms of what your own lived experiences and in relation to the larger macro context and how you take up the specific intellectual work of the different scholars that you revisit, whether that's part of looking at their work as a form of reactivation or reconstruction. And I definitely saw that more so in terms of perhaps, and correct me if I'm wrong, where you've kind of been at in the last 5 to 10 years or so working at UBC and your work with George Grant and the ways in which you situate the struggles, I'd say, or the conflicts or the tension that George Grant was dealing with during his time, in many ways in which you're articulating it are some of the same struggles or tensions that you are investigating through his work in relation to yours in that book. Is that a fair assessment of how you took up that project, moving images of attorney George Grant's critique of time, teaching, and technology? And again, I what really resonated with me in this recent project is more attention that you paid to the concept of reactivation and reconstruction. And I just read for a second here, you say, reactivation is a reformulation of the regressive phase of Carrere, a method of studying one's lived experience of curriculum that encourages not only the remembrance of things past from points of view in the present, but also a re-experiencing of their immediacy there, a temporal regression in the educational service of reconstructing one's subjectivity, of reconstructing one's subjective experience of the present. And you write later, recollection, I invoke reactivation, distress, experiencing the lived immediacy of the past when studying it, creates a space of non-coincidence with what is. And reactivating the past may enable us to re-experience such eddies and braids before they were woven into cloth or disappeared into the swamps. Such regression supports not only the revelation temporal relocation allows, adding missing pieces of the conceptual puzzle that is the present. It precipitates reconstruction of the present moment, altering the table, as it were, on which the puzzle rests.
Well, it seemed to me that that's what Grant was doing, even though he wouldn't use that vocabulary. He was so traumatized by the Blitzkrieg, the Luftwaffe's bombing of London, and almost died there, that these elements of his life, his father's injury in World War I, these elements of his life that predisposed him, I think, understandably and rightly, to have a skeptical view of modernity, and especially its those master narratives of progress and the inevitability of progress, that he went back 2,000 years. He went to Jerusalem and then to Athens, and he embraced it. Sometimes I think as literally true. That's the problem that those of us who live now face. The truth is so the concept of truth is so infected by scientific notions of empirical veracity, and then we succumb then to this idea that in some way the allegory of the cave is not merely suggestive, but it's in some way literally true, and I think Grant at times succumbed to that, although I hesitate to say so because he's such a much larger mind than mine. I think it's evident in the book that I was somewhat in awe of him. He was a very remarkable person, educator, and one whose classroom was really all of Canada. It was an astonishing and I think overlooked aspect of Grant's achievement. That he was, in fact, a great public intellectual and educator.
Thank you for that, Bill. And I want to thank you today for taking the time to come on to the podcast. I really appreciate your contributions to the field of curriculum studies and to the lived experiences of the students that I'm fortunate enough to work with this semester. But more importantly, you've played a huge role in my thinking and my career and the studies that I was able to pursue with you and Petra and Bill Dahl and Claudia and Denise at the Curriculum Theory Project at Louisiana State University have forever changed my life in relation to my own subject formation and now as a curriculum theorist working at the University of Ottawa. So I can't thank you enough for taking the time to be with us today. And I really appreciate your friendship and mentorship.
Well, thank you so much, Nicholas. And you must know how pleased and I am by what you've done. Your achievement is remarkable intellectually and professionally, and it's you've taken what I think you've studied at LSU and you made it your own and made it something else and something original and different and terribly important. So I allow me to commend you as well.